The first of the book, some 35 pages, is a very detailed family history of the text that could have been somewhat reduced as not very relevant to the rest of the story. The author then presents the contact experiences of Daniel Fry in his own words. Sean has combined the information from four different books to get a version as complete as possible. White Sands Incident, Steps to the Stars, 1965, Atoms, Galaxies and Understanding, 1960, and he also quotes from They Rode in Spaceships, written by Gavin Gibbons, 1957. A large of the book covers the history of the Understanding organization and the personal life of Daniel Fry. Here, for the first time, is a detailed and very fascinating story of the activists, ups and downs, the economic problems and controversies of the organization. Still, a few questions remain after reading this history. What happened to all the local units all over the country? With some 70 local units and 10 OOO members, how come such a large organization just collapsed? And what became of the arsonist who burned down the library and kitchen in the Understanding headquarters in 1978, then at Tonopah, Arizona? Who was this man and was he ever convicted? As Sean Donovan is an engineer and technician, several chapters are devoted to the physics and technical aspects of the Daniel Fry claims. Sean also presents his experimental evidence for and against Fry. Experiments that he consider promising and hope for an investor like Robert Bigelow to be able to continue. He has also started a website studying the physics of gravity, a name used to describe the physics of Daniel Fry. Not being technically minded nor interested, I can give no informed opinion on these discussions but simply recommend them if your interests are on the technical side. So, was Daniel Fry telling the truth? Like other UFO researchers, Sean Donovan concludes that Daniel Fry's film is a fake, the spinning model-like motion. The attempt at a second filming and the blatant visible supports are all evidence the films are false. What is missing in the book is an investigation and analysis of the Tahalita Fry UFO photographs taken in November 1968. There is also a reproduction of the bogus PhD degree that Fry received from St. Andrew's Ecumenical Collegiate, a title that made him call himself Drive Daniel Fry for the rest of his life. After considering the evidence for and against Daniel Fry, the author presents no definite conclusion but keeps an open mind. In the beginning of the book, he has a quote from astronaut Gordon Cooper: "I have seen my share of wide-eyed UFO fanatics and lunatics. Dr. Dan Fry was not in that category. I found him totally credible." Photo by Tahalita Fry, November 1968. The weak of the book is the author's lack of knowledge of the complexity of the contactee enigma. A complexity that takes a lot of study and field investigation of physical contact claims to comprehend. Contactee experiences are seldom a question of black and white, which was also the conclusion reached by psychiatrist Dr. Bertolt Schwartz, who investigated the contact claims of Howard Menger. On his Gravity website, Sean Donovan makes a comparison to other contactees and concludes that other similar contactee stories are fabrications, and in his book he claims, amongst Fry's contactee peers, there is nothing but bunk. Admittedly, many contactee claims of the 1950s were pure fabrications or misidentifications of mystical experiences. But not all of them. There is substantial evidence indicating that some of the 1950s contactees were involved in a cultural influence experiment implemented by a group of benevolent aliens from somewhere, with access to advanced Vimana technology. The contactees involved did not always understand what was happening to them and sometimes made a mess of the information delivered. That this was a psychological experiment to test the reaction of human society to alien contact is told by journalist Paul M. Vest, who was asked by a Venusian to help spread the message and experiences of Orfeo Angelazzi. The real contactees involved in the experiment were also told to use various methods to keep certain information secret, using blinds and code words in communication. Sean Donovan noted some of these diversions when he quoted Fry: "In composing my report of the incident at White Sands, I took great care to present it in such a manner that it would immediately be dismissed as nonsense by the military type of mind, and yet would present all the vital information in such a manner that its value could readily be understood by the type of mind capable of making use of it. By presenting this benevolent conspiracy theory, which is a variant of the esoteric intervention theory of Jacques Vallée, I admittedly become a heretic among scientific ufologists. But as Vallée has also stated, in Forbidden Science 2, the history of ufology should be placed within an esoteric context. If Sean Donovan had been a student of the more academic presentations of the esoteric tradition or science of the multiverse, Helena Blavatsky, Alice Bailey, Henry T. Lawrence, he would have noticed that the message given to Fry was a sort of simplified version of the ancient wisdom. This is especially evident in Daniel Fry's The Curve of Development. It is also evident in the messages given by Adamski, Ange Lussi, Van Tassel and Howard Menger. These few critical comments should not hesitate readers to acquire the book, which is an important contribution to the study of the classical contactees. And once again I would like to salute Sean Donovan for the excellent work with the Daniel Fry archive and websites. Kelvin Rowe and the Esoteric Tradition. In the 1970s, Timothy Good and Lou Zinstag traveled around the United States interviewing several of the first generation UFO contactees. The interviews were taped, and some years ago Timothy kindly sent me some of these transcripts, which I mentioned in my blog entry on Howard Menger. On August 22, 1976, they met and interviewed Kelvin Rowe and his wife. Rowe is not as generally well known as other contactees, but was a frequent lecturer in the 1950s and 60s. He lectured at the Giant Rock Spacecraft Conventions 1957-1959. His book A Call at Dawn was published by Daniel Fry's Understanding Publishing Company in 1958. I have advanced the theory that some of the original 1950s contactees were authentic and involved in a psychological, sociological test implemented by a group of benevolent visitors from somewhere, probably extraterrestrial. Involved in this test were A.O. George Adamski, George and Doris Van Tassel, Orfeo Angelassi, Paul M. Vest, Eugene Drake, Daniel Fry and Howard Menger. Could Kelvin Rowe also have been a of this test? The story and experiences told by Kelvin Rowe are in general the same as the other contactees. But Rowe was interested in flying saucers before his first contact and had met George Adamski and Truman Bethlehem already in 1953. The first experience was by telepathy on March 9, 1954. As described in his book, I was on my way to San Bernardino, California, driving a Ford pickup. I was thinking I would visit a friend of mine in Redlands on my way home, when the word Pluto popped up into my mind and was repeated three times. The words that followed were not too distinct at first, evidently due to my inexperience with and lack of understanding of the use of mental communication. P. 33. After 8 months of many mental communications, Rowe had his first physical contact with two brothers. They were fine-looking men, with smooth, dark sun, tan complexions, and dark hair styled in longer length than our modern cuts. The iridescent material of their form, fitting garments, similar in style to our ski suits, was unusually soft to the touch, firm but beautifully textured. After this first contact, he met the space people frequently, either at home or was taken up in their spacecraft. According to Rowe, he encountered both men and women, and the most of them came from Jupiter and Pluto. During the interview in August 1976, Timothy Good and Lou Zinstag asked Rowe some more details of his contacts. All the trips that I have made has been in the small craft. They have taken me to a small craft in a car, and then the car is left there on the ground, and someone else drives off with the car. There's always one man left with it. Lou, how many people are in them? Kelvin, generally five and six, on these small craft. Tim, I don't know if you've seen those particular pictures, road for TG, but that's 27 feet according to NASA. Were yours of similar type of, Kelvin? The ones I went on were just a little bit larger than that. But it would be in the same area. Tim, they have these spheres underneath, do they? Kelvin, well no, They didn't have these landing gears of that type. But some of them do, I have seen them with that. But the ones that I was on, mostly they had one that after they were going to land, if they're actually going to land, it would protrude down to touch the earth. But as I say, they very seldom did that, because when they once contact the earth, then it takes more force for them to break loose. They generally just sit there and hover. Like the other 1950s contactees, Kelvin Rowe sometimes encounter the visitors, dressed as ordinary earth people, mingling in society. He also claims to have been taken to Mexico in their craft, as well as below the oceans. In A Call at Dawn is mentioned that our brothers are operating on an entirely different frequency or spectrum than we are here as third dimensional beings. 111. Not very much has been written about Kelvin Rowe, nor has there, to my knowledge, been any in-depth investigation of his claims. On the internet, transcript of an interview that was made in March 1991 is published, but it gives very little new information. I wrote a letter to Rowe in 1984 but received no answer. The message from the space people, as presented in A Call at Dawn, is in general the same as coming from other contactees, but with one marked difference. Kelvin Rowe was deeply involved with the Brotherhood of the White Temple, situated in Sedalia, Colorado, founded by Morris Doriel, real name Claude Dogin. In the 1976 interview with Tim and Lou, he relates, "I have a doctor's degree, but I got this from the Brotherhood of the White Temple. I studied for this. Now, this doctor's degree I got gives me the right to teach philosophy and metaphysics, but that's all. It's not a scientific degree of any kind, and it's not nothing to brag about or anything." His book Rowe claims that the space people suggested he study the material from this brotherhood. They even approved of it as being the highest source of truth teachings available in the Western Hemisphere. P. 46, A Call at Dawn is dedicated to Mr. George Adamski, through whom I was led to realize the true reality of interplanetary visitors, and to Dr. M. Doriel, whose teachings have shown me the way. Rowe's book is full of quotes from various booklets written by Doriel, and sometimes messages from space people are actually verbatim quotes from Doriel, although not mentioned, especially from his booklet Flying Saucers, An Occult Viewpoint, probably published in 1956. This connection puts a great question mark on the claims and teachings of Kelvin Rowe. If he really met highly advanced space people, they would never have referred him to Morris Doriel, a very dubious character in the occult community. His claims and teachings are a travesty of the esoteric tradition. Noteworthy is this information from Borderlands Sciences Research Associates, who once asked the Inner Circle about Doriel, concerning this Doriel. His claims are not true. Certainly, he has a large following. Do you remember two people who had a following even of millions, whose claims were false? The Ballards. They gathered up the knowledge of many occult schools, they cast this knowledge forth upon the people with malice, and for gain. Yet well they knew what they were doing. Memoranda from the Mark P. Seances, No. 1, November 17, 1946. About this latter group, the I Am Movement, created by Guy and Edna Ballard, the Tibetan DK made some harsh comments. It is this truth, misinterpreted and shockingly travestied, which lie behind the teaching anent the so-called Ascended Masters, put out by the leaders of the I Am Movement. Alice Bailey, The Rays and the Initiations, 16. The claims of Morris Doriel are a strange mixture of esotericism and pulp magazine fantasy. In a 1946 interview for the Rocky Mountain News, he stated, "I saw atomic energy at work several years ago when the Dalai Lama of Tibet entered me into the Great White Lodge 75 miles under the Himalayas." Walter Kafton, Minkel, Subterranean Worlds, 155. When pressed about his travel claims, he said he traveled through astral projection. In the weekly sermon lesson for November 8, 1981, Doriel writes, "In the astral plane certain entities, forces and powers live. It is there the throne of God is, it is where the holy city of the Book of Revelations is found, in the astral are the treasure, houses and there all things man does are indelibly recorded on the Akashic record. These statements prove that Maurice Doriel is no esotericist but one of many occultists who have, in astral travel, totally misinterpreted his experiences in what esotericists clearly recognize as the plane of illusion. In the 1940s, Doriel was interviewed in several newspapers and magazines, sometimes photographed wearing gold robes, seated on a silver throne that he claimed was previously owned by Emperor Maximilian of Mexico. In 1946, Doriel made this prediction: "The coming avatar is now living in Tibet. He is a little over 15 years old. He was born in America, of American parents, and will make his appearance at high noon, May 2, 1956, at the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway, New York City. The sun will then be blotted out, but a golden rose light will spread over everything. A great ray of two unknown colors will descend upon him from the skies, and for 100 miles around, all sickness will be instantly healed." Round Robin, Volume 2, Number 7, July 1946, 18. Although Maurice Doriel claimed there existed guardians from space, Kelvin Rowe must have been surprised by this revelation from flying saucers. An occult viewpoint: the flying saucers are a menace to civilization. Believe me, they are not the Venusians or Martians who are coming here to have friendly relations with Earth, regardless of what some of the books tell you. I am not saying there hasn't been anyone riding in them, but it hasn't been anyone in this country. P. 36. According to Doriel, these flying saucers were manned by the serpent people who could change their appearance to look like ordinary people. These serpent people had a body like a man though covered with thin scales and the head of a great snake. They had the power to cause that head to assume human form in the likeness of anyone that they wished. P. 41. With this complicated background, how are we to interpret the claims and experiences of Kelvin Rowe? At the first International Convention of Amalgamated Flying Saucer Clubs of America in 1959, Rowe lectured on my 350 trips into space. Hardly a trustworthy claim unless he meant astral travels, like his mentor Doriel. To Timothy Good and Luzenstag, he appeared sincere. As far as I know, there are no witnesses to his contacts nor any photographs of spaceships. We only have his story. As he met George Adamski before his first contacts, could he simply have been an Adamski copycat, who used the contactee platform to spread the Doriel teachings he believed in? Or was he an authentic contactee, involved in the visitor's psychological test, but made a personal mixture of messages from the visitors and his occult beliefs? His book is filled with messages of goodwill and philosophy, often in accordance with the esoteric tradition. Perhaps further research by American investigators can find clues to the enigma of Kelvin Rowe. The UFO contactee no one investigated. There is one aspect of American ufology that has always puzzled me. Why have no serious investigators ever made in-depth studies and documentation of the first-generation contactees? Instead, there has been an almost total preoccupation with abductions and crash retrieval stories. The first ufologist who made an effort, in a more open-minded way, to document these contactees was the British investigator Timothy Good in cooperation with Luzenstag. Instead of thorough investigation, accomplished ufologists like Jim and Coral Lonson, Alan Hayek and Jacques Vallée simply dismissed these first-generation contactees as charlatans. Especially Hayek and Vallée should have suspected there was a deeper level to some of these often wild claims, as both were, more or less in secret, scholars of esoteric traditions. But they totally missed this aspect, and Alan Hayek commented on their philosophy as platitudes in stained glass attitudes, Hayek and Vallée, The Edge of Reality, 181. A somewhat more profound inquiry could have revealed to these two gentlemen the possibility of an actual esoteric intervention behind the scenes, orchestrated by the Higher Intelligence Agency, HIA. Because of this neglect in research, much data is now forever lost. Most of those involved with the first-generation contactees are gone. Research will have to be made with second-generation data, correspondence and interviews with relatives. My hope is that American researchers will, as soon as possible, initiate research projects with the following contactees: Orfeo Angelassi, George Van Tassel, Doris Van Tassel, Carol Honey, Helen and Betty Mitchell, Eugene Drake, Howard Menger, Paul Vest and Milan Cook. This should include studies of the first directors of Borderlands Sciences Research Associates, BSRA, Mead Lane and Riley Crabb. Renewed investigations into George Adamski and Daniel Fry is of course also of primary interest, although Sean Donovan has made a commendable effort with the biography Contactee. Was Daniel W. Fry telling the truth? An example of neglected research is the American Contactee Eugene H. Drake 1889-1973, director of the Fellowship of Golden Illumination. He is not even mentioned in UFO encyclopedias, and data about his life and experiences are exceedingly scarce. From my distant vantage point here in Sweden, I have tried to gather as much information as possible about this forgotten contactee. Excellent help with biographical data was provided by Joshua Bluebuzz. A real wizard when it comes to biographical information retrieval, as evidenced by his very informative blog on old Fortean researchers from an oblique angle. He is a real master detective in finding obscure data on various underground individuals in the Fortean world. Not even at IFU is there much information to find on Drake. We have his two booklets, Visitors from Space, no publication date given, but probably 1949 or 1950, and Life on the Planets. A Visit to Venus, 1950. We also have a single copy of his magazine Golden Light, Volume 10. Number 2, May 1962, and two letters written in 1962 and 1963 to Edith Neilason, founder of the New Age publishing house Parthenon in 1957. What made me especially fascinated by Eugene Drake was the fact that he, years before George Adamski, claimed physical contact with space people and was actually the first to print illustrations of the classic Adamski-type scout ship and cigar-shaped spacecraft. Something that has not been noticed, or at least mentioned, by American ufologists. An additional letter by Eugene Drake is to be found in the German edition of his booklet, Besucher aus dem Weltraum, published by Wendler Verlag 1961. Besides these data, there are a few, not very informative, mentions on the internet. Here is the extensive biographical information mailed to me by Joshua Bluebuzz, December 20, 2016. Eugene Harry Drake was born the 22nd of September 1889 in Warren County, Pennsylvania, to Zachariah Taylor Drake and Sarah Jane Jackson Drake. He relocated to the Los Angeles area no later than 1910, when he was there, living with his grandparents, and a sister, working as a stenographer for a hardware company. He was a private in the New Jersey and California National Guards. Drake married Priscilla Whitley Putnam no later than the beginning of 1917. They had two daughters, Priscilla and Irene. In 1917 and 1918, the family lived in Pasadena, at 539 North Lake, and Eugene worked as a cashier. Apparently, he also hoped to get into the film industry. In 1920, the family lived in Santa Monica, Eugene's mother-in-law lived with them. He told the U.S. Census that he worked as a manager for a film exchange. In April of 1922, Drake was arrested for embezzling $6,400 from the New England Mutual Life Insurance Company, where he worked as a cashier, to keep afloat his film production business. One source reported that he had been in hiding for a month, trailed by detectives, while the case of his forgery was made. I do not know if he served any jail time. He is in the 1923 city directory for Santa Monica, as a bookkeeper, but his entry could have been put together much earlier. He was also in the 1928 city directory, listed as a salesman. The 1930 directory has him too, but does not list an occupation. The 1930 census has him and his family, minus his mother-in-law, in Santa Monica, where he rented a house. He was a salesman of building materials. The Drakes lived at 1435 Euclid Street. This census tells us that Drake did not serve in World War I. I do not know why. He did register for the war, though. I do not otherwise know what he was up to during the 1930s. In 1942, he was living at 2503 4th Street, apartment 4, in Santa Monica. He listed no employer or employment with the draft board. 6 years later, he may have been living in Bell, California. There's a city directory listing that may have been him, or Santa Monica, but was going by Dr. Eugene H. Drake. I do not know how he earned the honorific. In November, he was advertised as teaching a series of Thursday classes at the Universal Truth Church in Long Beach. The subject was not stated in the newspaper ads. After this, you probably know more than me about him. He started putting out his books and magazine. He wrote about Mount Shasta and its little people. He started building his compound in the desert, where he claimed contact with aliens. He was mentioned in the Saturday Evening Post as using special tools in his research. He spoke at the Amalgamated Flying Saucers Club's first annual convention, 1959. He was mentioned in the Equals zine, Understanding. And he was referenced in the Journal of Borderland Research. We know that the flying saucer contactee Eugene H. Drake was the same as the white-collar worker from the 1920s thanks to The Open Way, number 3, 1952, which listed him as one of its members. It gave his address as 1014 So Lake Street, which was the address given for the Fellowship of Golden Illumination. It also gave a brief biography, with his birth date, the 22nd of September 1889, and his family situation, married with two daughters, which proved that he is the same man. It gives his occupation as writer, teacher, spiritual healer. He does not have an honorific, no, doctor title, though others in the directory do. He died the 21st of February 1973 in Los Angeles. He was 82. In his first booklet, Visitors from Space, Eugene Drake presents this summary of his contact experiences. For a long time, spacecraft have had this planet under observation. We have been in contact with them since 1930. At that time we were in Santa Monica, and contact was made in a large field where the Santa Monica City College is now located. Only during the past few years have they chosen to reveal their presence. 1. According to Drake, the contacts were physical, but the space people live at the etheric level of our multiverse and materialize themselves during the contact events. In his letter to Carl and Amy Veit, September 19, 1961, published in Besucher Ostem Weltraum, Drake makes these interesting comments. My translation: there are very few people who have had real physical contact with spaceships or space people, like ourselves. I have on various occasions experienced how space people appear in condensed form and I could shake their hands. After the contact they disappeared into a higher frequency. Drake makes it very clear that the space people living on planets in our solar system are not organic physical in the ordinary sense but living at the etheric level. This is in accordance with the esoteric tradition and was also the interpretation made by Desmond Leslie as to the reality of space people. Some of the information and the message presented in Drake's two booklets appear as rather unsophisticated and naive mysticism, not always especially reliable. But whatever the ontological status of his experiences, he is a very important figure in UFO history. Much of what George Adamski said seems almost copied from Drake's booklets. Scholars of Western esotericism as well as ufologists could find many fascinating clues to the origin of the UFO movement in studying Eugene Drake. If some of my research colleagues and friends worldwide find more data on Drake, I hope you will share the information. Most of the pioneer ufologists of the 1950s and 60s are now gone. That includes my old friend Gosta Jonsson, 1921-1993. He lived in Stockholm, worked as a constructional engineer and became an active member, secretary, of Ifologiska Sällskapet, the Ifological Society, one of the first UFO societies in Sweden. I find his name in the membership list of 1964. Gosta Jonsson's brother, Sten Jonsson, is the well-known trance medium, visited by famous actors like Shirley MacLaine and Dennis Weaver. Gosta Jonsson and I became close friends as he was my principal source in my investigation of the controversial contactee Richard Hoglund. I have discussed the Richard Hoglund case in several blog entries, and a summary of his story is printed in Timothy Good's latest book Earth, An Alien Enterprise. For those not familiar with the basic facts, a short English version can be found on this Norwegian site.